Hello, and thank you for tuning in. You are listening to BikeRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.BikeRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Mike Bond. He writes socially conscious thrillers inspired by his real-life experiences. His Aloha State thriller, Saving Paradise, and trust me, it is a page-turner, played a major role in stopping the big wind and the inter-island cable project in Hawaii. This project would have destroyed major parts of Molokai, Lanai, and Maui. In addition to drastic environmental and social effects on all three islands, it would have created a catastrophic impact on whales, dolphins, and other ocean species, including endangered monk seals and turtles. Mike, a Maine native, has also been active in Maine environmental issues, creating SavingMaine.org, to raise awareness about the potential dangers industrial wind development might pose to Maine's environment. Mike is a best-selling novelist, environmental activist, war and human rights correspondent, and an award-winning poet who has worked in many remote, dangerous parts of the world. His critically acclaimed novels depict the innate hunger of the human heart for what is good, the intense joys of love, the terror and fury of battle, the sinister conspiracies of international politics and multinational corporations, and the beauty of the vanishing natural world. For more information about Mike and his books, you can visit his website, which is mikebondbooks.com. And I do have a direct link to Mike's website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Mike to the show. Good day, Mike. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, Robert. It's a wonderful show, and I learn every time I listen. So it's great to be invited.
Great. Thank you. I'll tell you, when I looked at your experience, it was like, oh, my God, where am I going to start with this man? I mean, he has got so much going on and has lived so much. But I have to tell you, to start with, your media people are they're wonderful. The little sheet that I got, the promo sheet that starts with Bond Saves Paradise and Bond, Mike Bond, I mean, it fits perfectly. So.
Oh, that's very good. Yeah, they're wonderful people. That's Merrill Moss Literature. Merrill Moss Media Management. It's just wonderful. They're great people, and they really care about good books. So I'm glad you're having a good relationship with them, Robert.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was great because, you know, when I spoke to one of my colleagues the other day, and I said, oh, you've got to listen to the show. I've got this guy coming on, you know, environmental activist, great books. You know, I loved his latest book, and he said, well, you know, what's his name? And it's like, oh, that's easy. It's Mike Bond. And I said, and he writes like 007 was social conscience. So, I mean, it was a breeze. It was easy to remember, and boy, I tell you, that's valuable.
That's funny because, you know, when I first started writing novels, they were getting stacked in bookstores mixed up with Michael Bond, who wrote all the Paddington Bear books, and because my name is Michael. So I very quickly, in order to, because then what would happen is somebody would want the book and the librarian or the bookstore person would look up on the computer and never could find the darn thing because there were so many Michael Bond books. So anyway, we got rid of that by making it Mike Bond, which is, as you point out, Robert, very easy to remember.
It is, very much so. Well, you know, I want to talk about several of your books during the show. You know, of course, your most recent, Saving Paradise, which I read, I absolutely loved. We'll talk about that to begin with and some of the details of that, but I didn't want to miss the opportunity to talk about some of your other books as well. But first, I'd like to start with, you know, you write these books with a social theme. So where did that come from? Where did your consciousness and awareness and attention to social justice come from?
That's a really good question, probably one I never asked myself. It must have come just from a deep belief in fairness. And, I mean, when you're a kid, you're very attuned to what's fair and what's not fair. And that's why kids are always saying to each other, that's not fair. And because there's an inherent, I think there's an inherent morality in the human soul. And all we have to do is be aware of it. And the other thing, too, Robert, is experience. The more that you go out in the world and the more that you see horrible things happen, the more you think about why did they happen and the more you try to analyze it, and that comes back, of course, eventually to all of it, to social justice in one sense of the word or another. At least that's how it seems to me.
Yeah. From reading, it sounded like you had an interesting, childhood, as far as, awareness. We're going to talk a little bit later about Africa and that kind of thing. But but also, with the idea of being a war correspondent, to me that would be, I was wondering if that really, kind of played into you highlighting that justice and trying to, because when you're a correspondent, you kind of have to try to be objective, and as far as what's happening and what's not. Whereas, in your books, you can definitely make a statement.
That's very true. And, as a correspondent, you do want to be objective. I've written a lot of journalism, and you have to be. Otherwise, you're doing a disservice to the reader. But when you see a soldier take a rifle and shoot a little girl in the chest and or a whole family for nothing, it's pretty quick to understand which side is right and which side is wrong. And so you have to. The other thing, too, what I try to transmit in my books is what's really going on for the people who don't have a voice, for instance, or for people who aren't aware of something. I think we enrich each other when we share awareness, and so my books are just a way of trying to share awareness. And I don't know if that's answering the question. It's such a potentially complex question. But
no, it does. As a matter of fact, you even answered my next comment, which was on your, so that's how good you are. No, on your website, you have a stated philosophy, and you really talk about awareness and how important awareness is, how it basically can set us free, so that to me that was obvious, and it's great, to be able to have that be kind of the focus of your books. Now, your novels are fiction, and so why choose the fiction format for delivering your message?
That's a good question. One part is, having written tons and tons of nonfiction in the form usually of journalism, nonfiction has a very short life in terms of the experience of the reader, and it tends to be it tends to have an impact on the intellectual level. Whereas what I try to do using fiction, which is all based on places I've been and situations I've seen and usually people that I've seen, so it's not made up in an armchair. When I describe something in the jungle in Guatemala or in the savannah or in Africa, it's because I've been there and I'm describing a place I know. So what I can do because of that, Robert, is I can bring the reader right into the setting itself, right into the real world where that's happening. So it's almost like a drug in the sense that readers tell me that I change their lives because they end up living the exact experience exactly as the protagonist does in the book. And that makes that kind of deep connection with the experience, whether it's summiting a mountain in the Himalayas in the beauty of the early morning sun, and or if it's, as I said, watching a child shot by a soldier, all of that, or all the wonderful things that happen in between, love relationships, wonderful music, and if each time we put the person that we're sharing this experience with deeply in it, then it gives them the potential for emotional growth, emotional change, and that is awareness. That brings awareness.
Yeah, that's great. And it, to me, I mean, your book just had me captured in the first few paragraphs. So, and that's wonderful, because I think that's really what can get the reader involved. Not only in the story, but also in any kind of messages that you want to convey as well.
Well, that's very interesting, again, that you say that. I'm glad. I try to do that because life is exciting. And so if we portray life, it's exciting. And hopefully we'll get on to what is one of the basic things that I'm focused on, which is personal liberation as the only way to change the world, kind of thing. But whenever it seems appropriate, if it does, I'd love to mention that too.
You can bring that in any time in our discussions as we go through it. So I'm very happy to do that. Now with the the fiction format, the novel format, and the social message. I noticed there was one comment, I believe it was from Hawaii Public Radio, that called your book Saving Paradise an intersection of fiction and real life. So my question to you is, how do you straddle the line between a fictitious story and dealing with the real life social issues, points that you want to get through?
Wow. Well, there's the old thing about fiction being truer than, or imagination being truer than knowledge,
yeah.
And it really is. And the reason why is, again, because it's a deep emotional experience as opposed to a left brain intellectual experience, and it stays in our emotions and affects everything from our cortisol levels to whatever, blood pressure, fight and flight response. All of that is defined by our emotional cortex, and fictional accesses that emotional cortex. And so it's like, at one point, Robert, I talked about in my philosophy section about how where literature came from is from when we were all sitting around the campfire in our caves and talking about what had happened that day and who had seen antelope where and who had been chased by a cave bear. And we were sharing knowledge, sharing experiences, rather, in order to all become more aware. And that's what literature does. It's sharing experiences. And that's just what I'm trying to do. And because, again, it makes it very deep. And I think my books, I'm very careful in my books to not say anything in them that is untrue. You know,
okay.
Like supposing the Guatemalan army has only 10 tanks of a certain kind. I'm not going to say they have 25. If I talk about a piece of jungle, I'm going to talk about the real piece of jungle. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It does. You know, and I guess by kind of getting the reader wrapped up in the whole experience, then whatever that social issue is that you're kind of exploring or want them to be more aware of, then I guess it just kind of plants a seed maybe in their awareness to look at it, and doesn't come off as preachy in a way.
That makes sense, yeah. I was just thinking, what you got me to think of just then was, too, that we talk about people that care more about other people, or, you know, maybe the liberals care more, the conservatives care less, and it's, to a large extent, what it is the people that have had experience with a certain kind of situation are more aware of it. And I mean, I guess if you were to take somebody who was a little hard-hearted on the issue of welfare, for instance, and get them to spend a week with a family on welfare and see it from their point of view, I think we'd find a lot of social justice issues are just due to the fact that the people who may be opposed to things don't understand them. Or people who may be in favor also may not understand.
Yeah, that's very true. It's kind of, you know, walk a mile in my shoes or, you know, that kind of thing and see see what it's like.
Again, this comes back to what I try to do in my books. When I write something for my readers, it's to put them in a Maasai tribe in Kenya or in a firefight in the middle of the streets of Lebanon or a love affair in Colorado. I try to get that deep.
Yeah, amazing. Now, let's go ahead and kind of start talking about Saving Paradise, the latest book, and what I read. Now, I just had a trip to Kauai, but not one of those islands, but Kauai in March. So, you know, starting off reading about all the aloha, I mean, I was immediately transported back. So,
wow, good.
But this book basically played a role in stopping the Big Wind and Inter-Island Cable Project. So I would love to hear a bit about, you know, what that project, a little bit more about what that project was and what role your book had in stopping. For an author, I mean, to be able to write something that has such a great impact, you know, it's a dream.
Yeah, and sometimes it's very rare, but sometimes it appears that the pen is mightier than the sword, or at least than the billion-dollar bank account. What this is all about is that the island of Molokai is one of the five major Hawaiian islands and was recently rated by National Geographic as the sixth most beautiful island in the world. But it's much prettier than that. It's where I live part of the year, good part of the year. And it's just stunningly magnificent. And what goes on with wind power, these huge industrial turbines that are spreading all over the landscape and slaughtering birds everywhere, is that wind power doesn't work because wind is so erratic that you have to run fossil fuel power full time behind a wind project in order to even out the alterations in the input current, if there is any. And this called spinning reserve, which is done usually, as I said, with fossil fuel plants, ends up that countries with wind projects end up burning more coal or more fuel oil, as it were, than if they didn't have wind projects. And for instance, Germany is now back to the levels of 2005 in coal burning before it really installed a lot of windmills. And so the problem is that there's a perception that these wind projects are good, and so a lot of people favor them, particularly conservation groups, but the conservation groups are getting huge, huge donations from the wind companies. I mean, like recently the Sierra Club had to admit it got $28 million from the Natural Gas Institute, Natural Gas Industry, in return for not criticizing fracking. And now they're getting tons of money from the wind companies for pushing. They're a lobbyist for industrial wind. So the taxpayer pays all of it. The taxpayer, in some projects, the taxpayer pays a third up front as a cash grant before even the first shovel is turned. And then you have these hideous things built, paid for by the taxpayer at an enormous deficit rate, and they don't do any good. In the state of Maine, for instance, the three largest electricity consumers in the state, and not producers, but consumers, include more so even Bath Iron Works, one of the world's largest shipyards, and one of the world's largest pulp mills. The first three above them are all industrial wind farms. Because a lot of the time the wind doesn't blow at all, and you have to keep turning those turbines so they don't seize up, particularly in winter. Anyway, I could go on and on, Robert. I spent years in the electricity business, and so I know it pretty well, and I'm a total, absolute tree hugger. And it's time for rooftop solar, you know, each person's home. We have that in Hawaii, and we create more electricity than we use, and it's not expensive anymore.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm sorry, Robert. Please go ahead.
No, No. I was going to say, so with the this project that was in Hawaii, that was to create these wind farms and connect them somehow?
Yeah, the idea was that you run these incredibly expensive, huge cables through the National Humpback Whale Sanctuary, and which is where the whales come to meet and to calve. It's the most important whale humpback whale place in the world. So they're going to run all these extremely dangerous high power cables through these whale sanctuaries to link up these three islands of Lanai and Molokai and send the power to Oahu, and where there is no attempt whatsoever at trying to reduce power demand. And so anyway, to do this, they basically had to cover a good part of Molokai with these 550 foot tall towers that just slaughter birds at an incredible rate, and they make people sick. There's a thing called infrasound that these turbines create that actually makes animals they can't have, you know, they drop their calves early, the cows do, and people get sick and the kids get ADD. It's horrible. So that was what the story is about. It starts off, we can, I guess, mention the first page. The surfer, who's the hero, goes out into the ocean for a morning ride and bumps into a journalist who's been drowned by a whole lot of corrupt politicians and wind corporation executives. I mean, they didn't do it, but they saw that it got done. So that's the basis of the book, and it gives me a wonderful chance also to talk about my own family heritage in Hawaii, which goes back to the 1830s. And there is a Bond National Historic District on the north end of the Big Island because my ancestor was the first missionary on the Big Island. And instead of trying to spread a lot of stuff about God, he became an immense advocate and teacher for the Hawaiian people and a protector of the Hawaiian people. So all of that is in the book, and the beauty of Hawaii, the magnificence of the language, and the way the Hawaiian people live, how they treat each other, which is also fascinating from the point of view of inspiration.
It is very much. I mean, I love that aloha spirit. I mean, it is, to me, it's, there's just something about it that you can just feel the warmth once you get there. So now you created something called the Saving Paradise Project. What is that?
That is to funnel funds income from my books. Basically, all my income from my books, all of my net income that comes to me, goes to environmental and human rights projects, and just in the form of donations or other activity. And so the idea with the Saving Paradise Project was to do no more than that, to identify the proper recipients for these funds. And, for instance, I'm now talking with Worldwide Fund for Nature about doing something with them. And I'm very much involved with Defenders of Wildlife as well and with other groups that are trying to protect habitat and animals. So what the Saving Paradise Project is just the process. It's the commitment to and the process by which I switch those funds.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm so glad to know that. I had, it was probably about a year and a half ago, I had a pair of teenagers from Georgia. Their organization, they got their father to help them form this nonprofit called OneMoreGeneration.org. And their goal is saving endangered species for one more generation, you know, obviously for longer. But they're amazing. I mean, I had both of the kids on there, and they were just polished. They were just absolutely thrilling kids. They recently went to Africa and had been working with Saving the Rhino and had petitions they delivered to the, you know, the president of Africa and all kinds of stuff, have a documentary. So I'm going to drag them your way because they're doing just great things. And it's wonderful to be able to have that common goal, you know, to be able to get things done. It's so important.
Yeah, it's we're facing such drastic situations right now in the world. I mean, we are really looking at the end of nature, and in a very short time. And so, everything that can be done to help is really important. Whether it's the elephants, the rhinos, the wolves in North America, for instance, are under the worst pressure they've been in for over 100 years. It's absolutely dreadful. I expect within 5 years that the timber wolf, the gray wolf, will be extinct in the lower 48 states after having made an amazing comeback through the early 2000s. It's the Obama administration. The first thing they did when they got into office was to basically sign a death sentence on the wolves. What had happened is the Clinton administration decided to bring back wolves to the lower 48 that had been pretty well exterminated, and did so very successfully in Yellowstone National Park in Montana. And the wolves did what they were supposed to do, which was to spread in small quantities into the neighboring states. And as well, wolves in the Great Lakes area substantially increased their population. So in this policy of expanding wolf territory, because of the incredible benefits that wolves provide to the ecosystem, because of this benefit, that even the G.W. Bush administration expanded or allowed the expansion of wolf territories, and I was a co-author of the State of Colorado Wolf Management Plan, where we all agreed, ranchers, hunters, wolf lovers, everybody agreed that wolves wouldn't be harmed as long as they didn't substantially disrupt livestock. You do get wolves that do that, and then you have to dart them and take them back up to Canada or something. But anyway, the first thing that the Obama administration did when they got into office was try to take wolves off their own endangered species, open hunting seasons on them. It's just been absolutely catastrophic. Even in Yellowstone National Park, half the wolves are now dead, have been shot to death.
Wow.
So that's also a thing I work on, as well as obviously this tragedy of the elephant demise, which is mostly due to China. The Chinese people and the Chinese government will not stop importing this blood ivory. So the only thing I can suggest about that is to boycott Chinese goods, which my wife and I and our families do as much as we can. But, you know, you want to buy a computer or a phone, you know.
Well, you know what? We're about halfway through the show, so I want to take just a couple-minute break and then invite anyone, if you would like to call in with any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. Or if those of you listening in the chat room would like for me to pose a question to Mike, feel free to write it in there, and I will pass it on to Mike. And then, Mike, when we come back, let's go ahead and move on to the last savanna and talk a little bit more about the poaching, then your House of Jaguar, Holy War, and then, of course, we will definitely get in the whole topic of personal liberation, okay?
Sounds great. I'll be right here.
Great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Hey, Robert, it's Chris from Furious Times. Just want to let you know I read your book, Joy Potential. Thought it was an awesome story, and the twists and the turns were great. I felt like the characters were just really easy to relate to. I most appreciated how the book delivers some sage advice without making you feel like you're being lectured to, and without feeling like I was reading another one of those thousands of self-help books written by some spiritual guru. Very entertaining learning, and the book left me wanting to know what happens next. Thanks so much, and good luck with this book, Robert.
For more information, visit www.joybook.me. That's joybook.me. Or call 843-808-0777.
This is Roy Worley at mysticalship.com. R.T. Sharp has done it again. His new book, It's No Secret, Spirituality Bites, with BITE, B-I-T-E, being an acronym for Bringing Inspiration to Earth, has once again hit a home run. Unlike R.P. Sharp's first book, Joy Potential, which was a uniquely original story containing a message of hope and inspiration for everyone regardless of where they happen to be on their personal spiritual path. It's No Secret is a compilation of awareness, insights, guidance, and wisdom that can help anyone navigate through their lives on a daily basis. It's No Secret also contains resources and references that enable a person to find expanded information on a variety of issues that affect all of us. Order It's No Secret today. I guarantee it will be a valuable resource for help with whatever your needs are.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. And again, thank you to Chris and Roy for those testimonials. And again, all of those books are available at my website, biteradio.me. Okay, back to today's show. Again, my very special guest is Mike Bond, best-selling novelist, environmental activist, war and human rights correspondent, award-winning poet, and who the BBC calls the master of the existential thriller. You can find out more again about Mike and his books by visiting his website, which is MikeBondBooks.com. And again, I do have a direct link to Mike's website in the show page description. Okay, with that, we're back, Mike.
Oh, great. I'm glad to be back.
Okay, great. Well, you know, just before the break, you made mention about the poaching aspect. And in your book, mm-hmm. The Last Savannah, that's that you kind of tackle that issue in that book. So if you wouldn't mind kind of talking a little bit about that, I understand that you spent some time as a young man in Africa?
Yeah, I've been in Africa a number of times, and The Last Savannah is based on my experience with the anti-poaching squads in Kenya. But it is basically is the story of someone who goes out to try to stop the poaching, and that involves hunting down the poachers. And so that's what the book is about. It's much more complex than that. It weaves African tribal myths and a love story and all kinds of other things into it. And what basically it's based on is that right now where the situation is in Africa, in 10 years, unless we stop the poaching, that will be the end of the African elephant. They will be gone. They're killing over 100 a day, and it's almost all going straight to China. And what's happening now, too, Robert, is that Islamic terrorist fundamentalist groups are killing the elephants, and they are selling the tusks to China. So it's not only is it slaughtering the last elephants and contributing to this hideous global environmental offense, but it's also stimulating terrorism because it's putting a lot of money in the coffers of Islamic terrorist groups. So what the novel tries to do is put the reader right in the middle of Africa, right in the jungle, right in the savannah, right in what's going on. And the basic part of the book is a trek across central and northern Kenya, and involves the kidnapping of a woman who is the lover of the protagonist. So there's an amazing love story mixed in with this. What people say about it is that it's like being in Africa, that it's like taking a safari without having to leave the States. So
that's great. I mean, you know, that whole the plight of the elephant, you know, I mean, it's, you know, even like I said, you know, with the One More Generation kids and the rhino, I mean, it's like some of our greatest species are just being eradicated, and uh-huh. and it's, you know, and there's like, once they're gone, they're gone. There's really no getting them uh-huh. back, and it, you know, that along with, I mean, in addition to animals, I mean, plants, you know, and deforestation,
uh-huh.
and there's so many things that that we derive from, like from plants and maybe animals, that really are medicines for us. I mean, you know, they're discovering mm-hmm. all kinds of things all the time, and it's kind of like we're kind of eradicating our potential salvation in many, many ways.
Exactly. That's a perfect way to do it. Yeah, and eradicating our future. And that's a very interesting thought. A very interesting thought.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. And I, you know, so why is it that we do this? Why is it that we don't have the wisdom to perceive what we're doing so that we stop it? What is the thing that's missing?
Yeah.
Isn't that a nasty question? I mean, I think, and we'll get into it later, this is, I said earlier, that personal freedom is the only way that we're going to change the world. But back to the La Savannah, it's a man trying to save the woman he loves and trying to save the elephants and trying to save his own soul in an Africa that's full of war and hunger and revolution and drought. It's just, Africa today is an absolute and total mess. And, I mean, it's been easy to see it coming for a long time, but it's so terribly overpopulated that there's just little hope of changing things.
Yeah, it's amazing. I just hope that we get, you know, raise awareness enough and motivate enough people into action to be able to stem that tide, you know, and kind of shift it around. We can do it. I mean, it's been done before, so it's just a matter
Definitely
of will,
has.
I'm sure. Yeah. Now in House of the Jaguar. Now that one is, to me, that one is a story of. Kind of the CIA and the Guatemalan army, and apparently this is kind of stems from your own experiences as a foreign war correspondent, correct, in Guatemala?
Yeah. Yes, I in the mid-1980s, I went down there to Guatemala and spent, and the reason why is that the news coming out of Guatemala was so bad about the human rights violations that I felt that it was important to go down and see if, well, I assumed they were true because they were coming from reliable sources. But in addition, I felt that it was really important to spread the word. And so I went down and I lived in Belize for a while and would go back and forth across the border into Guatemala that way because oftentimes if you went to a checkpoint like on a road, the soldiers would just shoot you. I went in and out of Guatemala numerous times that way. I kind of wandered all over the country listening to people's stories, checking up on massacres. The army in the few early years of the 1980s had killed over 200,000 people. They just would go into whole villages and shoot everyone and set the houses on fire and leave. And the whole thing got started from United Brands was a U.S. fruit company, and they didn't want to increase their workers' pay. I forget what it was, but it was minimal. And so there started to be some strikes by the banana workers against United Brands. And so United Brands, and this is way back during the Eisenhower administration. So Eisenhower. The United Brands called in Eisenhower and said, "Mr. President, you got to do something about this. These people are demanding more money. It's going to raise the price of bananas." And so the president authorized the CIA, whose head at the time was John Foster Dulles. It was Allen Dulles. Excuse me, John Foster was the head of the State Department. They went in, the CIA went in the late 50s and did a very extensive job of working with the Guatemalan army to exterminate all of the people who might be protesting. And this grew and grew over many years into a full-scale resistance, and that's when I was there. And so I spent time with guerrillas, I spent time with soldiers, I spent time in the cities and the country, kind of got the whole sense of it, and that's the background to the book. And it, what happened, it was an extremely right-wing military dictatorship that was basically held, financed by the United States, and the Central Intelligence Agency had its own series of buildings down there by which they directed the army and the death squads. And as I said, the army killed over 200,000 people. The death squads, Escuadrones de Muerte, they were the most terrifying things because they would just snatch people off the street and throw them into these black vans and drop them a few blocks later with their throat cut, or would take them to the federal prison in Guatemala City and torture them. So they killed another 40,000 people, and then another 20,000 people were killed in just direct torture. And those are United Nations numbers. So that was the background of the situation, and I felt it was really important that the role of the United States in helping to foment this international tragedy be talked about, as well as the whole situation for all of those hundreds of thousands of people. A million people got chased out of their homes, I mean permanently. And I felt it's really important to spread the word about that.
It is. You're giving a voice to those who can't, and doing it in a way that hopefully shifts things. But boy, that must have been harrowing. That kudos to you for doing that. But
it was a little spooky. I mean, I was the last foreign correspondent in Guatemala in 1985 or 86, I forget which, when after over 150 journalists had been killed by the death squads. And the only way I got out alive, which is really funny in retrospect, is by an American Express card. This is not an advertisement for American Express, believe me, but when before I'd left for Guatemala that last time, I'd gotten an American Express card in the mail. Back then, if they thought you were semi-reliable financially, they would send you one. And I don't remember what the balance that they allowed you. But so anyway, I'd slipped it into my wallet just by accident, almost on my way leaving for Guatemala. And when I finally realized that I had to get out that day of Guatemala, this was months later, that I was going to be killed that day, and I managed to get to the airport. It was the most terrifying thing because I knew there were people coming after me. And I get up to the counter, and you could just get on a plane at that point, you know what I mean? But you had to pay, but you could use a credit card and just get on the plane. And the guy, for some reason, my Visa card didn't work. I don't know why. And I knew there was somebody coming that would take me away, and that would be it. So it turned out I remembered at the last minute that I'd gotten this silly American Express card. And, of course, it worked, and I got on the plane and got out to Mexico City.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. Well, you know, as I'm going through these books, I'm going to, now that I've finished Saving Paradise, I'm going to go in order and read them, you know, because these are just fascinating. Now, Holy War, that, you know, the book Holy War, you know, looking at that one, it's based on your experiences in the Battle of Beirut and the Lebanese mm-hmm. War. Boy, when I started reading about that, I thought, you know, this could be today. I mean, you know, this Holy War is still going on.
Definitely is, and it never stops. There's a number of reasons for that, but yeah, it's the Middle East has been that way for 10,000 years, and it's just always been a melting pot of conflict between one tribe and another, one religion and another, on and on and on. But what I try to do in a Holy War, Robert, is I try to get at what are the causes of war, what is it in reflexive in the human heart that turns to war, and how do we affect that? But I just put the reader right in the middle of that war, and right in the middle of the love affairs, and the danger, and the excitement, and the immense awareness that being in a war zone gives you. It's a terrifying time, but it's also a very you're hyper aware, because the moment you drop your awareness, you're likely to be killed. I try to put that all in the book for the reader, so that the reader can have been there too.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Again, when I looked at that, I thought, you know, this is relevant to today, and you know, it kind of makes. To me, as a reader, it would make me wonder, you know, and really look at, you know, the causes, you know, and why is this conflict gone on for so long, and, you know, what is it in human nature that keeps perpetuating it, and what will it take for that cycle to end, you know, and
yeah,
I guess that's
the
million-dollar question. So
that's what I keep talking about in my books. But I talk about the question in the hopes that we all can try to determine an answer. But Yeah, it's. I mean, you look at this horrible stuff that happened this week at the synagogue in Jerusalem. That specific spot, the Temple Mount, has been fought over for over 2,000 years, 2005, even before the time of Christ. There were people killing people over proprietorship of that site as a sacred site. So, yeah, I mean, the purpose of what I when I wrote Holy War, it's to it. In some reviewers have said, you know, what's wonderful about it is that I'm not pushing for any one side. I'm just describing everybody's situation as they are in it, whether it's an American journalist who's a British spy or a French commando who's on a revenge mission for the death of his brother, or a Palestinian woman who will kill anybody to protect Palestine, or a Hezbollah leader who's trying to find peace. So what another reviewer said is, if you want a ringside seat to what's really going on in the Middle East right now, this is the book. And that's what people seem to say, exactly what you have.
Yeah, wow. Well, you know, and then last book that I had information on is Tibetan Cross, and of course that one deals with the big bad CIA and nuclear weapons. So, but yeah, you know, go ahead.
Well, that was based, again, it's based on real situation, in this case Nepal and the shipment, the U.S. shipment of arms into Tibet to aid the Tibetan guerrillas, which was a very a reasonable thing to do, given that the Chinese had swept into Tibet and killed thousands of people and had destroyed, there were about 1,100 monasteries, and they destroyed all but a few of them, destroying all of these sacred texts and thousand-year-old books and all kinds of stuff. So, and driving a million Tibetans from their homes. It was a terrible time, and that led the United States through the CIA to start supplying weapons to the Tibetan guerrillas to fight against the Chinese. And so that's how the book starts, and from there it ends up as what happens with the discovery of a madcap nuclear weapon on the loose, as it were, and kind of a manhunt across all the way from Tibet to Colorado, and a love affair between the man who's trying to escape and the woman who's either his enemy or his lover, and you never know which.
Oh boy, got to buy the book and find out. Well, you know, your books seem to really focus on really some of ageless types of questions, you know, of humanity's inhumanity to self and to nature.
I guess so. Yeah. I guess it's as you say, it's an attempt, as you said earlier, Robert, an attempt to try to find out the reasons for some of the insane things we do. And that gets back to what I was mentioning earlier about the only thing that the only hope I can see is somehow that people become much more personally aware. And that involves a change. It involves all kinds of things on the individual level.
Yeah.
I guess I see that most people are not anywhere near, including myself, are not anywhere near as free as we could be, and therefore less happy.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of, you talked about personal liberation. Is that what you mean? What exactly, how do you see personal liberation playing into the equation of solving some of these issues?
Well, yeah, that's the absolutely topical question. Is there a relationship? And let me think a little bit about personal liberation. I mean, when I consider the years that I've spent working at tasks I didn't like for less money than I almost wanted to accept, and having hardly any freedom and not much of a place to live and no extra money to do anything or go anywhere, which is the situation of three quarters of the people in the world today. I mean, either they're extremely hungry and near starving, or they're working at menial labor and with no possible way to get out, or they're even in the States. I mean, if you can have a 3-bedroom home in a subdivision and have a cubicle in some building, but you're going to be there for the next 30 years unless you live outside the box. And I guess I'm encouraging people to do what I try to do, which is really think about how important life is, how short it is, and do you really want to spend a whole weekend watching television football and instead of being out in the woods or something like that, you know, or reading something that will bring you wisdom.
Yeah.
And to realize that we're basically serfs of a huge corporate political empire, which to a large degree directs and directs us and owns us. And the more that we can get away from that and become liberated, perhaps with less money, but more freedom, more time, more awareness, then if we can do that, then we, what happens, it, that each person who learns to be a little more free is like a tiger who's let free out of the cage and can help others to learn to be free. And each person who learns a little more freedom or who lives a little more freely beautifies, benefits the world. So it then when you have perhaps a greater sense of the reality of life, the power and profundity of life, then you're more deeply rooted to the world, and you, the idea of people harming people becomes atrocious. The idea of raping the Amazon becomes atrocious. The idea of widening a superhighway near you becomes insane. And you realize that there's no need for all this, and it doesn't lead to freedom. So I think that if we can become, each of us, more aware, then I think that that'd be a major way to change the world. That's just one take on it anyway.
Yeah, well, no, I believe that, you know, that's true. And it really, you know, the awareness, you know, awareness is critical. It's kind of, to me, it's kind of where everything starts, you know. But also we, there's this threshold, I think, that we have sometimes of, you know, of awareness and action, you know, and you know, I'm wondering from your perspective. I mean, you obviously have, you know, an expanded awareness on a lot of issues, and you have also changed and taken that awareness and turned it into action. You know, the Saving Paradise Project, et cetera. In your opinion, how can we motivate people to cross that threshold from awareness into action? What is it that you do that motivates you from, like, maybe a sudden, not a sudden, but maybe an informed awareness maybe you didn't have before, into taking action on that newfound knowledge?
Wow, that's a great question. It just occurred to me that in answer to that, probably writing is a very important part of it. And that what writing does, and this is so why I feel it's so important that everybody write, whether it's a journal, I mean, a paragraph a day, 5 minutes a day, or longer, or try to write poems. And if you're going to try to write poems, you can write them kind of in modern poetry, which tends to have no rhyme, or you can do what's harder and write rhyme poetry, but go deep, none of this silly stuff. And because or write short stories. Don't start a novel until you've written a lot of short stories, that's for sure. What I was going to say is that all that writing, it helps to sharpen our awareness, because once we're looking at something in order to describe it, we see it better. So I would say that'd be one way to cross that threshold, Robert. Another is to I don't want to say meditation. I'm not a meditating kind of guy, but to think about something, to sit quietly and try to work something out in our heads. And I mean, it's easy to dismiss something that like demonic butterflies are going to be extinct because of industrial agriculture and pesticides, and yet these poor little butterflies fly 3,000 miles to as part of their life cycle. They fly all the way from California down to southern Mexico, and they've been doing this for a million years? And we, in one generation, are going to exterminate them? So think about all that kind of stuff. And that tells us more about the world than who we are. And I also like to, I mean, just briefly, because I don't want to be going on too long here, but when there's a question to be resolved, such as crossing that line, to spend a few minutes thinking about how things really are, I mean, imagining the vastness of the universe, this infinite universe, and the infinite vastness inside each human body, how small the universe is as well as how large, and to try to envision how one's own brain is working, to think about the evolution of humans over the last 10 million years and where we might or might not be going, all those kind of things, even a brief reflection on each of them, helps us to cross that line and make our own lives more meaningful. Because when we cross that line, that's when our own lives come into focus and become valuable to us. And when we get to the end of our lives, we aren't hesitant to look back. We're willing to look back and see what we've accomplished.
Yeah. Well, you know, and so many people I know are really looking for that purpose or that reason or that understanding of, you know, of their existence, you know, and it's
mm-hmm.
And you know, I've only, you know, written a couple of small books, but I know even that short process, you know, to me has been it's been wonderful. You know, I mean, it's you know, opened up, you know, that whole line of thought and, you know, and inspiration and that kind of thing. So, but you know, that I was not expecting writing to be that threshold, but I am certainly going to let people know that is something that they can do to, you know, to really start taking action. I mean, it takes nothing to start writing at all.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. You could call your program Start Right, and then instead of R-I-G-H-T, it would be W-R-I-T.
Exactly. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, guys, we're down to... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please do. Please do.
I was just going to say we're down to the last few minutes. We're just down to the last few minutes. So, I mean, I just kind of wanted to, you know, that... I mean, this whole conversation has been absolutely wonderful. I've really thoroughly enjoyed it. And just one last question. You know, with your upcoming books, and when it comes time to deciding on a topic to write, do you kind of just look back at past experiences or maybe look at current events? How do you determine what it is that you're going to write next?
That's a good question, too. And it's a mix of things. And before I do get into that briefly, I do want to mention for your listeners that my publisher has a sale now on all my e-books except Tibetan Cross. And so if you're interested in any of these books, you can pick them up on Amazon or iTunes or Barnes & Noble Nook or through my website even at 99 cents a book for the e-books.
That's a deal.
I think that's where they should be, validly. You know, Fred, there's no reason to charge somebody $9.95 for an ebook that is, you know. Anyways, but that's another matter. But to return to what you said just in passing, and I'm most appreciative of the honor of being on your show. I think that it's the thing that bothers me worse is what I write about next.
Okay.
And or the thing that's deepest in my heart, that knowing that I could die at any moment, like any of us, what's the most important thing to get out there before I die? How's that? That's another way to look at it.
Well, that's great. Well, you know, Mike, this has really been, again, a real joy, and I really thank you very much for your time today. I've enjoyed our conversation. I'm going to take advantage of that 99-cent ebook deal and go right to Amazon now and download the ones that I don't have. But, again, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you sharing with us.
Well, I thank you, and for what you share, you know, every program that you put on, and you are bringing inspiration to Earth, and that's a great gift. So hello to everybody there, and I thank you very much again, Robert.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Mike Bond, best-selling novelist, environmental activist, war and human rights correspondent, and award-winning author. Again, he's his most recent book, Saving Paradise, is a page-turner. I loved every bit of it. And again, he has mentioned that his publisher has a special on e-books for that, The Last Savannah, House of Jaguar, are. So definitely go to Amazon and pick up those copies. Again, you can go to Amazon, or you can go and get them through his website, which again is MikeBondBooks.com. And there is a direct link to his website in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again. Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.